Verulam Sports.
Hello again and welcome to a very special 100th episode of Verulam Sport Podcasting. And we've been lucky to speak to an awful lot of stars, and we've got another one on the line now. It is the Raging Bull, Bill Vickery. 73 caps for England, 5 British Lions caps. One of those England caps was a small game out in Australia where I think they're playing for a trophy called the William Webb Ellis Cup. He's also 2011 Celebrity MasterChef and an entrepreneur in many guises. And it's always a pleasure to speak with Phil Vickery. Good morning. How are you, Phil?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for the intro. That sounds like you're talking about someone who's quite amazing. Not me.
Phil, I'm simply presenting the facts as they are. There's no spin in that at all. So, yes, indeed. Phil, lots to unpack. But I know, obviously, you're a proud Cornishman, and that's kind of where you grew up. And I know that upbringing had an awful lot of influence on your mindset and your kind of the way you approach life. Yeah. I want to talk to you about Exeter, becoming only the fourth team in rugby history to win a league and Heineken Cup double. What a great success. But goodness me, just a decade ago, they were kind of in the lower spheres of the rugby world. Talk to me a little bit about the job that Rob Baxter and inspired by Chairman Tony Rowe have done for that Exeter team.
Yeah, listen, I've said it openly, and it's just a wonderful story. You know, I grew up down in North Cornwall and played all my rugby, you know, Cornwall, and that sort of crossing over the border into Devon as a young kid. And, you know, all the Cornish boys went to Bath, a little bit Bristol, a little bit, but mainly Bath. So, you know, Graham Dorr, Martin Hogg, yeah. Andy Reid, all those guys. And that was always a natural progression. Actually, I got asked to go by Bath to, you know, there when I was at that kind of age. And I just think, you know, even speaking to my brother and my sister and their kids and them, they're just Chiefs fans. You know, in the fact, you know, the thought of if I was growing up at home and just to know you could go and watch Premiership rugby and top class rugby at Exeter, it's just amazing. But I know I've said this before. I'm taking credit for their double championship season because I did their season opening dinner for them.
You've inspired me. I love it.
But I remember being sat on the table. I remember driving back up the M5, back up to Gloucester, thinking, wow, I'm sat on the table. You know, for those of you that don't know Rob Baxter, I don't particularly know him that well. I've met him a few times, had a conversation. You don't need to, just the way he talks and the way he is. What a fantastic guy. Tony Rowe, you know, I got there. So I get to Exeter, I think, however many million pounds they've raised through their foundation. Charitable foundation. Tony's there, handing checks out, driving it, you know, set up the foundation, that's what we're going to do with local charities. He's there, he's hands-on, Rob's there, doing the pictures, he's got the trustees all there, amazing, all different charities, I think Wooden Spoon were there actually, and a load of other different things. And then you get to the dinner, and you start looking, and no, this might sound like nothing to you, but for me, it's just the detail that often goes missing in such a simple way. So you get there, there's 400 or 500 people in the room, all the sponsors. The menu, it's Devon food.
You know, nice
it's yeah, and drinks and wines and desserts and names. And suddenly you're like, wow, you know what? They're supporting regional, local, and feeling proud of that. The people in the room, you know, and it's like Rob said, you know, it's a members club. You know, this is a members club. I just remember driving back home thinking, hang on a second. I live in Gloucester. I spent 11 years at a club, which I dearly love and fell in love with the place and, of course, the rugby club. I really feel part of Exeter. I'm here talking to you now about it. I really feel a part of Exeter Rugby Club. And I thought, wow, what would I give now to be able to go back and be part of a rugby club like that. It's just, I just think it's amazing. But it's the way that they've done it. You know,
it struck me that it's been very well managed. Sometimes when you see these things and you move up rapidly, there's a tendency or an inclination just to throw money at the project and hope that that's the best. And our world and sport in the moment shows that that is very rarely the way. But it seems to me that Tony Rowe, allied with Baxter, had a very clear goal that they were willing to work towards that steadily, take these little detail important sort of 1% of moments you mentioned and achieve that goal. I think that's the kicker for me.
Yeah, well, they're creating a culture. A lot of people use the word culture. Mm-hmm. Culture doesn't just happen overnight. And look at Saracens is different in the sense of, you know, what's happened. But ultimately, Saracens was about culture. When I arrived at London Wasps, the Waspies, it was about culture. And when you see what Exeter have done, particularly, it ultimately was about. But I remember in the early days, everyone was saying, he's not going to survive. I can remember pundits talking on TV, they need to buy big. They need to buy a lot of players. Well, this is after they beat Bristol, was at the Memorial, wasn't it? When they went up, mm-hmm. they stuck to their guns. And even in the early days, it was about survival. It was built on scrum, line out, drive, defence, energy, passion. And suddenly everyone's saying, well, what more can you bring? But they built from the very basics. Now, I'm sat here talking to you, having retired, for 10 years, and the game's changed and evolved, mm-hmm. and methods and techniques and words and language have changed, which is fantastic. The fundamental basics for me of the success of Exeter this year, and having watched them play, has been about scrum, line out drive, kick chase, defence. Mm-hmm. The actual basic principles of the game haven't changed. Yes, you've got to add on the safeties and those sprinkling of absolute brilliance, your Jack Knowles, particularly Jack, the Cornish boy, I talk about him all the time. But, mm-hmm. but you, of course, the players and those bits of brilliance. But the fundamental basics of our game are as relevant today as they have ever been, which I think is fantastic.
Do you know one man who really kind of embodies that for me in their playing sense is European Player of the Year, Sam Simmons, and his brother Joe also, yeah. captain as well, two great stars. Again, they've lived this dream. We're going to talk international rugby in a moment, but I just want to touch on Sam. As I mentioned, European Player of the Year, richly deserved. Should he be a factor in Eddie Jones's thinking? Surely he must.
Well, I think well, he has been, hasn't he? He has been, and without question, he will be part of that, you know, in the future. But I think, as Eddie, as always, you never quite know. And mm-hmm. Looking at the balance of back row, and also for Sam, his consistency, and he's had his injury issues, which kind of is always an easy out, perhaps sometimes for coaches or for people who are in charge, but. I think what it says for me more than anything, so I'm a rugby fan, you know, I love our game deeply. Mm-hmm. What it does is it inspires next generations and even me as a fan. When you see the way that he plays and what he can do, it makes you just go, wow. And then when you start layering on the fact of all the things we're talking about, being part of an amazing club, mm-hmm. going about your business in a sensible way, not trying to create headlines through doing crazy stuff or saying crazy things. It's just about playing rugby. And the same for Joe as well, by the way. I think I take my hats off to him because, Gareth Steenson has been around a long time at that rugby club, has been a huge part of building that rugby club in that pivotal role. And I think the way that Joe's gone about his game and the way that he's played and the way that he's kept his, human touch and the fact that we are all need. And I think the acceptance, well, that it is a squad effort and it's not just one player. And if I had to think about other teams and other clubs around the country, and you think if they're missing a couple of players, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
Exeter, strength in depth, but strength in depth of character, mm-hmm. not just superstar. Strength in depth of what actually that rugby club means and what that organisation means to the player. And that you cannot buy.
And again, that all stems into, as you brilliantly explained, the commitment to maintaining a culture. It's not just creating a culture, it's then building on it. Joe Simmons, 23 years of age, became the youngest man to captain a side to Premiership glory. Just before we touch on that game against your old team, Wasps, in the Premiership-wise, just focusing briefly on that epic, which is a great advert for rugby, I thought, their game against Racing 92. Two different rugby cultures kind of demonstrated right from the kickoff or before the kickoff, with Racing coming out with kind of pink bow ties to almost celebrate their elan and their kind of romanticism. great game of rugby. We've praised the wonderful team and evolution that has been Exeter. Touch upon Racing, though. It must be galling for them, because I think that's their third defeat in five Heineken Cup finals in the last 5 years. So near, but so far.
Yeah, listen, I think I actually love that light and shade of our game. And if you were outside looking in and you knew nothing about our sport and you looked at that final and actually did a little bit of looking around and looked at the Racing, the team, the what it stands for, the way it goes about playing the game in comparison to an Exeter, you couldn't find two different vehicles, really. Yeah. But ultimately, they're similar in the sense the passion, the will, the drive, the determination, it's just inspiring to watch two such different animals do battle. And for Racing over the years, and I remember having played with but also against Richard Paul Jones, who played there for so long at Stade, and being over in that environment, I remember talking to him about it. And I actually not had an opportunity to go over to Paris once, and I just wasn't right for me to do. But I would love to have experienced being part of that, and I can quite see why players get excited. Forget the money side of things, but I see why people get inspired. And imagine being a fan of that rugby club.
Got such an array of stars, haven't they?
And it's just phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. But I think that's what I love about our game, really. And I think we talk about the professional game, and I think one thing I always try and say to people, the elite professional game is a very different game to our grassroots game. I don't mean that in a nasty way or in a way which is derogatory to anybody, but the thing which brings it all together and it is aligned and similar is that you have the collision of different people, different cultures, different mindsets, different abilities. And that is very similar to grassroots. I talk about, when I started, the reality when I switched, so I take it all back. I know we're talking about something different, and I apologise for waffling
on. Not at all, Phil.
But the reason I got involved in rugby, there was an opportunity and a space for me. In a lot of other sports, there weren't. And I think, yes, it's the elite professional game, and you've got galactic superstars from all around the world, but then you've got Exeter, who sort of bred and created this wonderful, proud club, which they always have been, but with a proud city, from a proud area, from a proud region, and suddenly everyone's feeding into that, and not just feeding into that, the clubs, the supporters, the people, the families, the producers, the businesses, and suddenly all that collided in that wonderful one-off game, two totally different styles of play, and it created the most spectacular event. And as a rugby fan, of course, I wanted Exeter to win, but actually, as an example of what our game can do through all the negativity around sometimes, that's why we watch it, isn't it? That's why we do it.
It was a wonderful advert, wasn't it? It really, really was. But you talk about style there and different styles. Again, the nuts and bolts of rugby, whether it's at grassroots and you're just starting for the first time, or at the absolute uber elite at international level. We'll talk international rugby shortly. The fundamentals, as you say, are the same, but it is the different styles of game that come out depending on the strengths and weaknesses of various sides, which I've always found compelling. And almost to illustrate that, we have that just a few weeks later in a completely different game of rugby where Exeter beat Wasps again narrowly to get that double, which is fantastic. Yeah. But I want to give a massive amount of praise to your ex-team Wasps here. Again, I know you won the title with them, I think, back in 04. But my goodness me, they only knew they were going to be allowed to play in this final, I think, the Wednesday before. What Lee Blackett has achieved there going forwards, I think this Wasps team is one to watch for next season. They lost narrowly, but they certainly didn't disgrace themselves in context.
I just think it's when you look at the results that they had, obviously the disappointment of Dai leaving, Dai Young, and the reaction. I always talk about you've got a couple of choices when things aren't going very well. You can either roll over, and I think for Wasps would have been quite easy because obviously the Saracens, the relegation battle has been sorted, or you can do something about it. And I think the reaction of this Wasps team and what they've done, Lee Blackett, and also I think Jimmy Godpuff needs to take a lot of credit for this as well, has just been nothing short of sensational. And, you know, to get to that final, and I know the disappointment, I'm lucky, you know, my first two seasons at Wasps, you know, I won a European Cup, won a Guinness Premiership. So it was habit for those guys. And I think that's what that weekend was. It was an Exeter team who just come off the back of a European victory. And then it just becomes about winning. And really in the end, it was a team which physically and probably mentally feeling pretty drained, but they just knew each other inside out. And it was going to take an incredible performance from Wasps. And I actually do think it was an incredible performance from Wasps, but they just got picked on the day by a team which are so at ease and are so together, and just it wasn't about performance for Exeter that game. And that's what I always say to people: performance is brilliant, winning better.
Like, it's a habit, isn't it, Phil? You get into that habit, and then you almost kind of, you know, we had it in football, didn't we? The Fergie time, where there's sort of, you know, you turn narrow defeats into draws. In this context, Exeter win.
But even as a fan, you accepted that. You accepted that they were going to win. You accepted, you know, I'm not saying the Wasps team accepted the Exeter. I think they're an amazing, you know, I spent 5 seasons at Wasps Rugby, and I fell in love with Gloucester. 11 years there, amazing club, and still is an amazing club, and still a club which I've got a great, huge affinity to. Of course, I live here. It's my home, my family. I was there in the week, you know, and I've got a great relationship with them. I think I'm all right in saying it's not, I wouldn't say anything I shouldn't say, but during the first lockdown, I got put on I'm not a huge fan of WhatsApp groups because it becomes a...
It beeps all the time, doesn't it?
I think it was 260 or 50, 60 odd ex-players, girls and boys got set up on the Wasps Legends WhatsApp, old girls and boys. And that's the amateur team as well, the FC.
Yep.
Go. And I tell you, people doing videos, celebrating, raising money for charity. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely, you know, bike ride, I think Roger Utley had over 50 odd Waspies go on a Legends bike ride around Northampton somewhere a couple of weeks ago. It just, that rugby club is, you know, the saying of once a Wasp, always a Wasp. Mm-hmm. I tell you, it is unbelievable. And I feel so privileged to be part and to have played a little tiny role in that club. And I think, of course, the move to Coventry, it's disappointing, different, but I think it's fantastic. What, you know, they potentially have got the launch pad there to really move on and show people what the future of rugby is about. And I think, you know, Joe launched me there as well.
Yeah.
Joe was a little tiny pup when I left, and to see what he's doing. But, you know, there's so many. I don't like picking names and players and stuff out, but I just think it's, for me, it's lovely to see.
You're dead right, and you're dead right to not really want to circle in on individuals. Rugby is, as you understand, maybe the ultimate team sport. But I'm going to do just that, I'm afraid. I know you mentioned they're involved in the Wasps Legends WhatsApp group. A young man at the early phases in his career, I think, has superstar written all over him. Great family pedigree. I'm talking, of course, about Jake Umaga, called up into the England squad. Got so much imagination in his boots and his hands, quick thoughts, and I just think he's got a real talent. Again, rugby, not a one-man game, but just briefly, your thoughts on that young man and where he could well take his game.
Yeah, well, I think, I think the exciting thing is that, you know, you've got someone who's so talented, so skillful, but at the same time, such clarity of thought and the way that he moves, the way that he drives the team around. Just an observation without knowing Jacob, it's like a real old head on a very, very young shoulders. I think that's the exciting bit for me, being an old you know, coming from that forward pack, when you've got someone with skill, precision, endeavour, aspirational plays, the way he moves, and but suddenly he also understands that can't be all the time nuts and bolts, percentages, you know. And I'll say, going back to that, I think word culture, but being in an environment which allows or gives opportunity for a young man like that to be able to play like that and behave like that, that says to me there's a lot more right about the culture of of Wasps rugby than perhaps we know about, because it you know, that's exciting for everybody. It's inspiring for next generations of players. It's inspiring for us as supporters, but also from a club and from a culture and from a player retention and looking at future and building squads. Those are, when you sit down, those are the kind of players that you want to be talking to people about, and this is what can happen. This is how we nurture. This is what goes on. And it almost goes back to the full circle to when I first had conversations with Wasp from here at Gloucester, because obviously didn't want to leave Gloucester. And I remember going to see the guys, and it was actually Craig Dowd and Ian McGeeken, the conditioning guys. And it was like, right, you know, then Raf Ibanez is on the phone to me. Old boy at the end of his career. This is what they've done for me. Rob Howley was straight on the phone to me. Listen, this is what the guys have done for me. I got an extra few years out. They really looked after me. They value you. And then boom, boom, boom. And then suddenly it's like, wow. And I know I get a bit emotional about that, but it's kind of, I felt like I was valued. I felt like they understood me. I felt like they wanted to get the best out of me, because if you get the best out of Phil Vickery, or you get the best out of a Danny Cipriani or a James Haskell, then you're going to do great things. And suddenly you're in an environment where, you know, a front row consisting of Phil Vickery, Raf Ibanez, who Raf probably plays him his best rugby for Wasps, you know, Tim Payne, Simon Shaw, exactly the same. And then, you know, it just bred success. Then, you know, big LD at the back, you know, Alex King at 10, been around for an awful long time, which allowed then that Danny Cipriani, Danny coming in and certainly nurturing. I talk about, you know, we talk about Mr. Amunga there, but, you know, Jimmy Gopoth as well, very similar roles. I just think it's often something which is talked about, but actually not really understood the importance of that. And
Do you know what's interesting about the whole cultural dynamic? I think those that really do it and they live it, they don't talk it. I think those that talk about it don't really understand it. But that's just kind of observation. So moving onwards though now, and really appreciate your insights here. Before we drill into international rugby, great result for Scotland beating Wales. I'm going to talk a moment about the legendary Alan Wynne-Jones. But just briefly, I was delighted to see Doddy Weir inducted into the Scottish Rugby Hall of Fame. The last time you and I spoke, I know you were gearing up, sorry to use a pun, for a big bike ride to raise an awful lot of money for Doddy Weir charity and MS awareness generally. Just your memories on that great man, and, you know, just anything else that you can do, if there's any other current events in the pipeline.
Yeah, I think, listen, you know, we're all deeply saddened, and not saddened, but just it touches a nerve, you know, particularly with you and anyone around you, but particularly with someone like Doddy, because people who don't know him, you know, the guy is larger than life. I don't mean that just because he's like 8 foot tall, but when Doddy walked in a room, you knew he was in the room through noise, laughter, often cheeky grin, drinking something or another. And I think for me, when it was announced, and you know, trying to message and trying to call, left a voicemail, and obviously the rugby world, the next time I saw him was in New Zealand, because he always said he wanted to do a Lions tour with his family, and I didn't know. And I was actually working for EY at the time, and they're in Auckland, and he walked in with his three boys, and I just remember being sat, I think it was me, I can't remember, was it, it was Brian, it was Driscoll, Brian O'Driscoll, Justin Marshall, Kenny Logan, and I just remember looking at him thinking, what must he be thinking? And I, you know, I start, you know, start welling up a little bit. I'm looking at a dad. I'm a dad. You know, got a couple, and he's there with his boys, and his boys know. He knows his boys know, but he's cracking on. But the guy's positivity, and you know, he knows that it's not going to save him, but he wants to be part of the cure. And the thing now, regardless of where everyone's understanding of motor neuron, I mean, very sadly, you know, used, particularly from the rugby world, used to underestimate, and who I played against and very lucky to have met a few times. Was it 30? I think Doddy's, it's like 30 odd years, and Doddy's still getting the same treatment 30 years on. Well, that's just not right. And just because it's not popular, it doesn't get the funding. I mean, how crazy is that? So it's kind of, you know, we've done dinners, we've all been involved in various guys doing different things. I've got the Doddy tartan, I've got the Doddy tartan cap for my golf, I've got bow ties, I've got, you know, and it just, everyone's just trying to do as much as they can. Very lucky to saw him at horse trials at Badminton a couple of years ago as well, which was great to catch up with him, his wife, and my wife as well, which was lovely. But also, you know, Rob Burrow, I've got my Rob Burrow shirt as well. You know, just trying to support and I don't know, just be good. You know, we were talking before we started recording, just trying to be and do good things. Now, one of my big bugbears, and you want to get me going now, I'm having a rant.
Go on, Phil.
But the thing is, sometimes with charity, I do feel a little bit sometimes that unless, you know, you've got your legs and arms tied up and a sack on your head and you're running around the world 26 times, you know, pulling a lorry, it's not worthy of anything anymore. And I just think, just doing what you can do, even if it's just writing a message or letting Doddy know, or letting whatever your charity, whatever you're supporting, just letting people know that you're thinking about them, and giving a pound, 50p, 20p, 10p, you know, just giving and giving it energy, and, you know, just giving your time is precious. And I kind of, that we need more of. And for someone like Doddy and what he stands for, if you said to me, right, someone who is positive, can lift the room, can do attitude, and go on. It's like, well, it's not about being the best rugby player. I think the best, it's just about being good human beings. And I think the rugby world is as good a place and the most energised world to be able to help with things like that. And, you know, when I remember the dinner that organised down at Battersea, the Evolution, I think it's 1,500 people in the end. And I remember the conversations about it, people saying, well, he's a Scotsman, we're having a dinner in London. How is that going to work? I can't remember. There were over 100 odd international rugby players there. It was just, you know, the list was just incredible.
The great and the good.
Yeah, you know, and I just think for that, for me, sums up what is bloody wonderful about our game. The challenge is, how do we do things like that and celebrate without having a bloody train crash to make it happen? You know, without having to have a something seriously wrong for us to do that. You know, that's what I, you know, want to challenge, always say to people, you know, not talking about just doing it for fun, but we mustn't forget the great values of our game and what we stand for, and all what we are, and our people and our volunteers. And, you know, even bring it all right back to today, to basics, you know, us talking, communicating, want to help out, talking about it, being positive, whether that's Bude Rugby Club, Longlevens Rugby Club here in Gloucester, or Cinderford, or, you know, Bristol, Exeter, Gloucester, Wasps, you know.
It's a brotherhood and a family, isn't it, at the end of the day? And I think that's the most important core message for us all to recall, refresh. And Phil, as you said, before we even started recording, the major message that I picked up from you was when you spoke really passionately about the body language that we can present, a smile. And it sounds so small, but over time it's these little things that I think we need to remember and get back to. That's just my take on it.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I repeat it over and over again. And that doesn't matter whether I go in to see the guys at Raging Bull or whether that restaurant, you know, I've opened a restaurant over in Cheltenham, not open now because of COVID. But I just say to the team, the first most fundamental thing for me is you and the way that you are and the way that you present yourself, the language you're using, your body language. And a lot of people talk, oh, yeah, whatever. But you're up here talking about down here. Get down here and talk about it. And then... Look up, you know, because it's in that. And even when I go back to my rugby career, it's not about being, I was by no means perfect. I'm cranky, can get a bit whoppy sometimes, a bit off, can go missing sometimes, need to have a minute. I've never shied away from that. It's probably why I'm not hugely good in organizations that aren't prepared to listen, because I will call it out. I will let you know, but I expect that to be given to myself as well. But don't question me when it came to delivering or commitment or passion and pride. I'm all in, but don't faff around with me talking to me about myriads of absolute rubbish. Yes. Which mean, you know, it's about, you know, and that for me, I think is as relevant today as it's ever been. It's about being positive. It's not about being perfect. This thing, like social media and everything's perfect picture, perfect life, perfect moment. Life's not perfect. It's not about being perfect. It's about just about being good and having a good outlook on life, being inspiring people, laughing, smiling, joking, and not about being bloody perfect all the time.
Phil, you always put a big smile on my face. Again, would touch on international rugby and then build towards your great entrepreneurial outputs, which I know is you put that kind of authenticity, that honesty, that passion as you did into your rugby career. But just briefly, I want to talk about Alan Wynne-Jones. Scotland got a rare victory over Wales on Super Saturday. Not necessarily the best or most fitting occasion for the great man Alan Wynne-Jones, who became rugby's all-time most capped player, winning his 149th cap. 140 for Wales, 9 British Lions caps in there. Just your thoughts on Alan and that great career that he's enjoyed.
Well, it's just, you know, phenomenal. I think the lovely thing about Alan Wynne-Jones is not just the game and the way that he's just relentlessly, you know, Duracell battery kept going and going and going. But it's the way that he's done it for me. You know, the language that he's used, the way he's held himself, the way he's talked, as far as inspiring people who are with him, but also supporters, fans. You know, I think he is, you know, is the greatest Welsh role model, I think. And that's from outside looking in that you can, and, you know, having played against him and with him, you know, my last Lions tour in 2009, I remember, you know, it was Simon Shaw, he was on the bench, came on a few times. And I remember thinking, I remember talking to Warren Gatland about him. And I think at the time he'd got like 50 caps for Wales. And he was like 12. You know what I mean? He kind of, there was no way at all. And I remember Warren telling me, you know, he said, he's a baby. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, if this guy can stay fit. But I take my hats off to, the one thing it does tell me, I take my hats off to the Ospreys for the way that it's been managed, and without knowing anyone at the Ospreys, but that it tells me as a supporter and someone from outside looking in that they've managed him brilliantly. He's managed himself and his family have looked after him, and also credit to the Welsh Rugby Union as well, the way that they've managed him and looked after him. I mean, people can say he's been a bit lucky with injuries or been a bit... But I think you make your own luck. He looks after himself. I remember on the Lions tour in 09, very professional, very thorough, and goodness me, cares deeply. You know, cares deeply about what he does. And for that, you know, I've always had a huge amount of respect for the Welsh and the way they play the game. I think it's a Cornishman in me. Their desire, their passion, their histories, their heritage. Yep. But just the way that he's gone about it for me, if you had to pick someone, which said Phil, who would you pick as a representation of what rugby means and how you go about playing and behaviour around the game, Alan Wynne-Jones for me is the number one.
He's one of only seven Welsh players all time. And you talk about that great heritage, what great names in the 70s and even before. But one of only seven Welsh players to have earned three Grand Slam finals. Of course, captains the British Lions multiple occasions. I mean, it's a great rugby CV. I just wonder, though, yeah, we talk about the importance of that Welsh passion for rugby. It's a borderline religion, maybe only matched by the New Zealanders. But is there concerns at the moment for Wales? Wayne Pivot comes in. I mean, it's 18 years since Scotland got a Six Nations victory against Wales. It's 97 years since Scotland actually came from behind as they did to beat Wales away. Five straight losses for Wayne Pivot. I think, to be fair, too early to kind of, you know, get the vultures out. But do you think there must be pressures based on this Six Nations performances for the Welsh culture right now?
I think the easy answer is to say yes, there is. But I think when you take into consideration what's gone on and particularly this season, the international season and what's happening, very, very difficult to judge. But if you just park that aside, the current climate and the environment which we're trying to play international rugby and domestic rugby, I think anybody who's going to follow on from what Warren Gatland has done with Sean Woods and Robert Bride and Rob Hack, I mean, probably one of the best coaching setups in world rugby outside of New Zealand, perhaps, certainly in my mind. So it's always going to be a difficult transition. I think from my view of Wayne Pivot, from outside looking in, I think it's really positive. I think it's really exciting for Welsh rugby and particularly for one thing that Warren and his team always did was bringing through the next generation. Yep. So I think Welsh rugby is in great hands from that sense. And I think for me, Wayne Pivot has done the right thing by coming in and not totally decimating what's already been done, because what's been done's pretty good. I think there will be an element of landing, having a feel, getting that integration of next and not suddenly just changing everything, but slowly, surely, I think we will start to see the Wayne Pivot Welsh rugby and what he feels, and if the Scarlets were an example of what this Welsh team's going to be like, me as a passionate Englishman, I'm excited to see what this Welsh team can do. And regardless of whatever anyone says, going back to your thing about Scotland or about all the home nations, I can honestly say it gives me, and people say, oh, it gives me no pleasure in seeing a nation struggle. It's not good for our game.
Yeah.
Seeing a Welsh team who's struggling, an English team who's struggling, a Scotland team who's struggling, an Irish team who's struggling, or a French team who's struggling. And I think actually at the moment, when you look at world rugby and what's going on, Southern Hemisphere, I mean, Australia and New Zealand can play each other 100 times a year if they want to.
Yeah.
For me, it's just the same old, same old, same old. I think it's brilliant rugby. I think it's fantastic to see. I think New Zealand still lead the way. Mm-hmm. But when I look at Northern Hemisphere rugby, and forget about the challenges of our grassroots and monies and commercials, when I see what the French team are capable of, when I see what the England team can do, when you look at where Ireland are and their transition, that's exciting. Look at Scotland, and look what they can do now. And for us to compete on a global stage, it's all of us by being better. The only problem is, and I keep saying this to people, as fans, we need to accept you've got a team which potentially can win the Six Nations, but you've also got to accept you could finish third or fourth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, and that's a brutal reality of it.
And you know what, though, but that's why we truly love it. Still is the case, though, isn't it, that it's you and England's 03 team, the only Northern Hemisphere team to be World Cup champions at this moment in time. Too early, I think. We're obviously in that next wave, building towards France 2023. But my goodness me, impressed with what we're seeing with France at the moment. They came second, just on couldn't quite make up the point points differential to overcome England. We'll talk England in a minute. But we're talking rugby cultures. I love the fusion here of Galtier, you know, a great scrum half, a great rugby acumen, alongside, you've already mentioned him, a man you know very well, Sean Edwards, to add that defensive grit. France have impressed me this tournament. I thought they were very strong in beating Ireland at the weekend. It will be France 2023. This is an exciting, developing rugby culture that I think is only going to get better, Phil.
Yeah, Fabien Gaultier, having played against him and watched him for so many years, was probably, if you had to describe the rugby player as delicious, he was delicious. You know, but he played the game so brilliantly, and he was a craftsman. He was a master of his trade. And I can remember speaking to him at length, because at the time, around the 2000s, with Philippe Saint-André being at Gloucester, mm-hmm. and having a heavy French influence, and knowing quite a few of the French guys, I always, you know, edged towards them. And I remember having conversations with Fabien after 2003, in the semi-finals. And he said, you've stolen my Rugby World Cup medal. And I think when I look at that, and he didn't say it, not in a bad way,
no.
but just that was his moment, his time, mm-hmm. and that team. And I'm talking about it now, so, you know, goodness me, you know, 17 years on, I still remember him saying that and having a conversation. And don't get me wrong, he didn't belittle or begrudge me or any of us what happened, but it was like, wow, yeah. And I think seeing what he's doing, and Raf Ibanez as well, you know, being involved with France, I think is wonderful, because I think what Raf will do, particularly for Sean Edwards, because Raphael and Sean worked together at the London Wasps, I think it will give Raf will be a really good barrier to understand, to get the psychology and the mentality, because Sean Edwards is one of the best rugby coaches I've ever worked with.
Yep.
But the word mental doesn't do him justice. You know, he's absolutely crazy. So I think the Raphael Ibanez and Sean Edwards relationship, as far as the players, I think is wonderful. Mm. But just Raf Ibanez himself is just an amazing guy. And suddenly Fabien Gaultier as well. You know, they've got a wonderful array of talent there. And, you know, Rugby World Cup 2023, I'd have to say, you know, I got sent a message a couple of weeks ago. I think, you know, this time, whatever, 13 years, I lost something. I've been England captain, losing in a World Cup final in France, and to think in 07 to be playing France in France in that home stadium, Raf Ibanez, who I was playing with at London Wasps at the time, you know, me and him captain. And I can remember walking down the tunnel in that, you know, in that semi-final, I'm thinking, this is deja vu. And I'm thinking, goodness me, Fabien Gaultier said we stole his Rugby World Cup in 03. And I'm thinking, wow, we've got the opportunity again, semi-finals again. But magic, I'm just going through my head. And, you know, magical moments. And I think France, their rugby, their passion, of course, infrastructure, but their country is a beautiful country. Mm-hmm. And I think rugby fans are going to be in for a real treat in, you know, for 2023, because it'll be magical. And a whole nation with a realistic chance of competing and going all the way will just add another layer of brilliance to the whole thing.
You know, I really appreciate your passion and your great memories again, Phil, there. And love the description of Gaultier as delicious. We'll talk about your expertise in the kitchen pretty soon. But I think they've got two tasty players in the crucial halfback roles. Antoine Dupont, for me, maybe the player of the tournament. And we spoke rugby bloodlines. A man who certainly oozes that is the fly half, Romain Untermaak. Just two players who seem to know each other's game incredibly well and seem to be able to add a level of intensity to that 9-10 axis. I think, like I say, France certainly are building a very, very exciting team in the now, which is going to grow into the future.
Yeah, I think if you can get your drivers in the team and the people steering the ship working well together and understanding, if you can keep that partnership and the understanding, of course, we've already talked about the coaches developing the right mindsets and the right attitudes. You know, I don't think France have ever been short of talent. I think they've just been a little short-sighted and perhaps kind of a little bit short in the sense of being able to galvanise that talent together. Yeah. And give it some stability and some direction. And I think now with this French team, they've got that, and it will give opportunity. And I do also feel, to talk in a little bit of a broader sense, I think the French league has struggled because of the influx of players and the way that it's been. But I think also you need to flip that around a little bit. And actually, so what are the experiences of this of these global superstars, which are coming to play in our league? How can we use that to excite and accelerate the development of our own players? And I think they spent a few years in the kind of, for me, it's just an, not me, I don't know, but it's just an observation for me. Spent a few years in that kind of slack water of, what are we? Yeah. Well, we've got influx, or we're a big league, we've got the top 14 and Dallaire and Toulon and Dallaire and all my Racing, and it hasn't really done them any favours. But now it's kind of, do you know what? Not we've hit rock bottom, but it's kind of, this is where we're at. They've gone to the youth. You know, the youth have competed World Cups and done well for many years.
I think defending under-20s champions are the French. Yeah, and a lot of that have filtered in.
Yeah, so they've got kind of gone right. They've messed around with generations. They've almost, for me, this is sort of gone right, let's go and find that success.
Yeah.
Let's go and accelerate that and stick with it. But you know, with that comes the responsibility of management and of people who are directing the ship to commit and to want to you know, see it through and understand that. You know, it's a bit like, if I use my little journey, you know, Clive Woodward identified me. You know, I was 21 years old, tight head prop.
I think you only played 34 games, hadn't you, before you were thrust into the international arena?
30-odd games for Gloucester. But he committed to me. It took you know, it takes probably a year. Well, I always used to say it takes about a year and a half, a cycle and a half of games, so you even understand what international rugby is about. Because actually, it's easier than playing club rugby because it's faster. You need to, but all you're doing is concentrate on what you're doing. But my point is, Clive and the coaches committed to me and, you know, and saw it through, and it gave me an opportunity to land. I had to prove myself, of course, but I had an environment where I could do that. And I think this French team particularly, seeing where they're coming through and what's happening there, that's really exciting. And going back a little bit to Wales, I can certainly see that happening there as well. And then when we look at Scotland and Gregor Townsend and what he's doing, what he did with the Warriors, what he is doing now with the Scotland team, and seeing the conveyor belt of talent which is coming through, you know, really, really exciting. And also, you know, from an England point of view, you know, and seeing, you know, what Eddie's done with the coaches, little change up, seeing develop, looking forward into 3 years' time, of course, but also in Ireland with, you know, Mr. Farrell. And what he's doing there and the success of that Ireland team. So I think
Farrell, I tell you what, is another man. We spoke about winners and winning attitude. He has just been nothing but a winner his whole life, whether that was back with the Warriors in rugby league, through into his achievements with kind of Saracens. Everywhere he's gone, he has won. I think this transitional Ireland side, not the greatest Six Nations, however, I wouldn't be worried. I think they're in safe hands.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the only sad thing really was that I don't think Andy, you know, obviously his misfortune really coming into Union. We didn't see the best of him. I know League certainly had the best of him anyway, I think. But I think it's a shame we couldn't have seen so much more from him. But it's just great to see his mentality and the way that he is. I'm lucky to have played him a little bit, which was great. And I just like being around the guy. Very simple, very straightforward, very, you know, not unassuming, but just gets on and works hard. And you can see it with Owen, you know, almost like a chip off the old block, gets on with it, relentless, always looking, analysing, professional. And I'm just really pleased for him and obviously delighted for Ireland, because going back to my original point, for Northern Hemisphere rugby to work well, we need a strong Ireland. And I think they're certainly what are going, but are transitioning through, and I've got a great conveyor belt of talent coming through. And yes, the power shift from Munster has certainly gone to Leinster, but you know, Irish rugby, I think, is in a super place.
I think you've made a brilliant point about how strong across the continent European rugby is at the moment. And for the global game, that's a very positive thing. England, of course, in this very protracted year, claimed the Six Nations Championship. They defeated Italy. Just want to keep this relatively brief, Phil, because I truly value your time. Just quickly, a few thoughts on Eddie Jones. We've kind of touched on it in passing. That's now three Six Nations Championships in just 5 years under Eddie Jones's stewardship. The great Sir Clive Woodward, who you experienced, you've already talked about his culture and his visionary kind of qualities, also won three, but in 7 years. Eddie Jones, of course, coached England to a losing Rugby World Cup final. Thoughts on Eddie and England? I'm sure we talked France 2023. England will be determined to go one stage better. I'm absolutely convinced they've got everything possible to make that so.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know with the Eddie Jones scenario. I think I just always feel like the glass is half full with people when they talk about Eddie. I mean, my experience of him, obviously not as a coach. I mean, I've played against his teams and having met him, one thing I always say about him, I can't talk from a player's point of view because I've not played, like I just said, but a winner, he's a rugby man, wants to do well, always looking at different things. And I just think what he's done with England in comparison to where they were has been fantastic. And you know, seeing the way that he's developing, the coaches coming through, what's happened, you know, Steve Borthwick now, someone I play with, I have a huge amount of respect for now, Leicester, of course. But I'll be interested to see, you know, his replacement and how that works. But I think the game in English rugby is in a decent place. I mean, it might not be overly exciting. We might not be talking about it with the same bit like we talk about France and Fabien Gauthier and Gregor Townsend up in Scotland. But ultimately, just quietly going about his work and going about his business, and by and large, is picking the players which we're all talking about. So I think he's doing a brilliant job.
One man that he's showed commitment to is Ben Youngs. Credit to Ben, becoming only the second England player all time behind a man I'm sure you know very well, the fun bus, Jason Leonard, to reach the landmark 100 caps. And he marked it in style, didn't he? A brace of tries. Ben Youngs, I think, he's a performer who really likes the big occasion, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, he's been around a long time, but still there at the coalface, you know, and you know, rightly, deservedly getting his 100th cap for his country, which is fantastic. But also, from an England supporter point of view, which I am, having someone like that in the team with all those experiences, you know, working with and being alongside the next generations. We talked earlier on about balance of team, making sure you get the right blend, the right mixture of characters, the right mixture of experiences as well. And certainly Ben, I think the way, it's not just, going back to my point a little bit about Alan Wynne-Jones, it's not just about the way you play, it's the way you conduct yourself. And I think Ben's always conducted himself and talked in a brilliant manner, whether he's playing for Leicester or whether he's playing for England. So from that point of view, I think it's just fantastic to see someone you know, getting that number of caps at that level is just tremendous. I mean, I think someone said to me at one point, I've got 73 caps. I think I was injured for 70 something, like pretty much 50-50 split. I said, but that's irrelevant. you can't do anything about that. I just think for him to get 100 caps in any world is brilliant, but particularly in the position that he plays, and to be up to speed physically and mentally at that level, I take my hats off to.
Phil, really appreciate that, and I totally value your positivity. I don't want to be anything but I've got to ask you this. Italy have now lost 26 consecutive Six Nations matches. You have to go back to 2015 against Scotland for the last win. This can't be doing them any good as a developing nation in rugby context. Is there a case now for a two-tier Six Nations?
I have openly said, and I believe I'm always a glass half full person. I've openly said many times, I think one of the biggest tragedies and where people are not fronting up in our governance of our game is the Italy situation. To see where they are now, having over 20 years in the Six Nations, and to see that this is where they're at, I think people should be holding their heads in shame. And it's a little bit like a political job. Well, X amount of billions of pounds have been spent, this billions, millions, gazillion. That means absolutely bugger all. You know, I think we've let Italy down. I don't know necessarily all the answers, but something has to change, because it's just, I don't think it's healthy for anybody. Two tier or the opportunity. I think the one thing the Rugby World Cups have thrown up, you know, as always, is I do think we need more meaningful second tier rugby. It needs to be meaningful. And I believe the only way you can really make something meaningful, and if we strip it all back and go back to the very basics, when we're talking about, we started off talking about Exeter Rugby Club, if they didn't have the opportunity to play in the big league, would they have done what they've done? The answer is no.
Indeed.
So I do believe, yes, I say meaningful second tier rugby, or the opportunity for the next generations to come. But also, I'm also talking about the opportunity to be in that Six Nations. And I think if we are serious about it, then we need to seriously have the opportunity for another team to get involved. And the quicker they do that, the better. And one day, if that's an England at the bottom, or a Scotland, or a France, or whoever it is, then so be it. I do think we need to look at it.
I think rugby as an international level really needs to address this. This crosses the world. I think the way Argentina consistently make semi-finals at Rugby World Cups, have only very recently been allowed to have some type of competitive international tournament play with the big three down under. You know, I think an interesting kind of movement. What's your thoughts of the Nations Cup coming up, with Georgia currently ranked 12th ahead of Italy and Fiji currently ranked 11th coming to our shores? Could this be an interesting bridge towards something positive?
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, I can't help, the cynical person in me can't help feel that they're just, you know, that they're just filling spaces and making work in what is a tragic global pandemic. But at the same time, it will be an opportunity for these teams to show what they can do. I mean, I think one of the biggest travesties of world rugby is we spend all Rugby World Cup talking about the island nations and how amazing they are and what they bring to our game, not just on the field, but off the field, the whole spiritual side of what they do. I think they've been treated like second-class citizens, and I think it's unacceptable what's happened to those girls and boys. And, you know, it's tragic for our game. But also looking at this autumn series and seeing that it's up to those nations actually to step up and show what they can do. But I think the important thing to get across from me is, as cross as I get about it, giving meaningful rugby and giving opportunity then allows for investment and allows to inspire next generations. And, you know, I hear this thing about, you know, growing our game globally and becoming a global sport. If we are really serious about creating a global sport, we need to create a global calendar. We need to be joined up thinking and need a global response and plan for our game globally. Now, sadly, for us sat here and wanting to have our Six Nations in February, March, and below it, we might have to move. So we can't have everything and not give. Now, I believe if we can start aligning ourselves with each other with a common plan, with a view of the game globally, I think our game can really thrive and develop in the world at a lot faster a pace than it is. Because world rugby, or the global game, if you were outside looking in, and I don't possess to be a business guru or an expert on anything, but hang on a second, what their seasons are played at different time of the year. So how does that work? Well, they tour there So why do they play each other six times and don't play such and such? Why do they not play there, or they only play once every 3 years there? Why are those nations in the rugby, but we don't see them play for the rest of the year? Why are we not doing inter country season champions winners against champ? But because what do you mean the difference? So it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So we are stronger together. I want to sound like Donald Trump then. I don't want to sound like but you know, we have to get joined up in the way that we think for the sake of our whole game, for us as supporters and people who are on the side of our game, but for likes of my son who watches it and all our supporters and next generations, they can actually look at it and go, wow, I get that. That makes sense. Because at the moment, as much as they can spin their numbers and talk about all these things, and I just think it just doesn't sit very easily with me.
Phil, I think you've posed some very strong questions, which I really rather hope those with the current ability to influence at the highest spheres of our great game will heed. Because as you say, it is collectively that we move on and develop. And that mentality, Phil, and it's been wonderful to talk rugby with you today, but that mentality, that collectiveness, that vision has been something that you've applied post your rugby career. Very excited to learn about your new restaurant endeavor. But just before we talk about that, remind me again about the wonderful Raging Bull range and how we can engage in that and get involved in it. Christmas coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think I've always been interested in even when I was, you know, obviously full-time playing, I think having positive distractions is good. And obviously being called the Raging Bull and getting that nickname, and then thinking, right, you know what, let's do something clothing, go on, and started off with sportswear and sports and team kits. But then the realisation, when you look around a rugby stadium, we talk about lifestyle and lifestyle brand, I think a rugby stadium is probably one of the best examples of what lifestyle is. You know, nans, grandads, aunties, uncles, sisters, cousins, all shapes, sizes, ability. It's just a wonderful arena. And then to have, you know, started my brand and to start the lifestyle side, it was probably a lot of people said I couldn't do it. It can't be done. It's, you know, don't, no. And I'm thinking, why? So, you know, lots of blood, sweat, tears, lots of endeavor, lots of amazing help and people along the way. And, you know, I'm really proud to sit here today and to know that, you know, we are a global brand.
Brilliant.
And that, you know, that makes me feel extremely proud. I think my learnings from it, and certainly my learnings from the sporting arena, understanding what you're good at and excelling at it and energizing it, but also from my sporting world, understanding what you're not so good at or what the challenges are, and plug those holes with people who do know. It's teamwork, it's being part of that. And, you know, even from the restaurant, I won Celebrity MasterChef, and I didn't go on MasterChef to win it. I just went on it because the farmer in me, the food in me, I've loved food. You know, there's always been around food. And I'm genuinely interested in the show. And then to have won it was like, wow, what's that allowed me to do is promote food, promote farming. Of course, Red Tractor, but not just British, just to promote good things around food, which I'm hugely passionate about, because my farming upbringing had a huge influence on me as far as my rugby career. You know, food and farming are very, very closely linked. I mean, you talked about the Youngs brothers earlier on, but, you know, farming, rural communities and rugby are very, very tight. So it's very, very important to me. And the same people who are buying my Raging Bull kit and have helped me build that business. Now, the restaurant, I thought COVID, but we'd set to go and we were going to do it, and we've committed to doing it. I've got an amazing team, Tom Raines, my head chef, who is just brilliant. I've known Tom for donkey's years. We'll talk about doing something together at the end of last year, and we're doing it. The support, the one thing I love more than anything about what I've done and continue to do are the people. I tell you, if you turn that news channel on now, I guarantee you within 30 seconds, it's negative. There's something terrible going on. There are horrible people in the world. I know there's some baddies out there. I know there's some challenges going on out there, but day to day being in restaurant and seeing and talking to people, people's support and loyalty and enthusiasm and smiles are just absolutely bloody brilliant. The support I've received, well, not just me, but Tom and Elliot and Jules, the whole team, and Adam and Aidan, it's just mind-blowing. And it gives me so much strength to know what people continue to. And I see it from a raging bull, you know, continually emails. I mean, you get the negativity. There's always something.
You do.
But people are just bloody amazing. The people that work in the business, what they do for me, above and beyond, caring. You know, great example, I didn't know anything about it. Steve Hayes actually used to own, you know, Wasp Rugby Club. He emailed me the other day of an email that he received from Val, from Raging Bull, who looks at customer services. And he just said, Phil, that is just amazing. And he's done that off his own back, so I didn't know.
That
makes me feel so proud. And I know that happens over and over and over and over again. And,
Phil, just remind us, please, of the Raging Bull website. So, like I say, I know you've done so much to set this up. I know it's a global brand. How can we learn more about it? And, you know, like I say, treat ourselves as family members. Christmas just around the corner. Yeah, no,
get on the website at ragingbull.co.uk. Have a little look around. The lovely thing is, we look after everybody. We've got the girls and the kids, well, of course, but because we go up to 6XL across the whole range, so we look the big boys and girls too. We don't talk about it and pretend. We actually look after everybody. So go and have a little look. There's plenty to find out. Or if in any doubt, give the guys and the team a ring and they'll sort you out for sure.
Fabulous. And the restaurant, again, we respect at the moment, obviously under lockdown conditions, but we're confident that will come out of that strong and then the restaurant will launch and build. What's the name of it and where is the location?
Number 3 restaurants, and we're over in Cheltenham. Get on, follow online, Instagram, Twitter feed. But there's all the website, number3restaurants.com. You can have a look at menus, look what's going on in events. I'm doing a MasterChef event on the 28th of January. But we've got all the Christmas dates, opening times, good British, honest food with integrity and passion, great team, reasonably priced. Get yourselves out, enjoy it, have some good food. You know what, the lovely thing, and there's number 3 because of obviously my number and my journey, but actually the 3 things are food for me, the where it comes from, the farmer, and of course the cooking of it, the master chef, loving the cooking. But the third bit, which we often forget about, sharing it with friends and family and coming and enjoying it. And the way my menus are set up, it's very much about, you've got your tomahawk steak, you can have, of course, but actually it's about sharing. It's a smaller plates as well. A lot of fish that comes up from Cornwall, which is a link for me. So it's, hey, listen, if you get the opportunity, come down, you'll be more than welcome.
Phil, it's been awesome for me to have the opportunity to talk to you about your rugby journey, the current state of the international game, and your phenomenal endeavours. I want to take a moment to say thank you for joining us on our 100th Everham Sports episode, and I want to very much sincerely say a big thank you. Keep well to you and yours, and I wish you every continued joy and happiness. Thanks again. Hello again, and welcome to a very special 100th episode of Verulam Sport Podcasting. Woohoo! We've reached the ton. And I'm delighted to welcome back for this very special episode, I'd like to say, friend of the show, the amazing Cliff Crown, Radlett's own Cliff Crown, and more crucially, the chairman of Brentford Bees Football Club. Cliff, how are you? Welcome back to Verulam Sport.
I'm fine, thanks, Tony. How are you?
Well, goodness me, it's a peculiar old year, isn't it, 2020? Accordingly, I try to keep things simple, stupid, if that makes sense. So I just appreciate my little lot. I'm very privileged to do what I do here on Verulam Sports. And I'm grateful to be in reasonably good health, knocking on wood, and have good friends and family. Anything beyond that, I think, well, you're doing okay. But yeah, that's me, Cliff, and yourself basically keeping well.
Absolutely. Staying well, staying fit, and keeping away from the virus is the number one priority for all of us. It seems to be one challenge after another, but that's the way of the world right now. And we just have to grin and bear it, get on with it. And thankfully, as an elite sport, we're going to be able to carry on playing Championship football. So plenty to look forward to.
There absolutely is, and I'm delighted you clarified that, and I'm delighted that that is indeed the case as the Bees continue a really solid start to the season. Lots of efforts, currently sat in ninth place after nine matches. So a fairly kind of mixed bag, four wins, two draws, three defeats in that nine. We'll build up to two massive matches coming up, and again, delighted that as an elite sport, this is a season carrying on. But just briefly, Cliff, what's been your impressions for the kind of opening few months or so of the championship campaign this year round?
I think there's some obvious things that we're all aware of in football.
Yeah.
One is that, first and foremost, we all desperately miss the fans. And I feel that most clubs are suffering, particularly at home, by not having fans there to support them and cheer them and push them to victory. So I think that's why we're perhaps seeing some more away victories than we have past, statistically. So that's a number one miss. And I think the other really big thing that we've all noticed in the first couple of months already is the onset of more injuries, strains, players getting slight injuries, not so much the big injuries, but ones that keep them out for 2 or 3 weeks.
Yep.
So a lot of the teams are having to put people in, take people out, manage the resources. There's been question marks over substitutions at games across many of the teams. And what fans don't necessarily see in the background is that all of us in football clubs are monitoring our players and managing the enormous schedule that they have. The number of games between now and Christmas is quite remarkable. And so the players do need to be very carefully managed.
Brilliant points there, Cliff. Really appreciate that. And it is going to be a challenge for all this campaign. But above all, I'm just delighted that there is elite level football for us to enjoy. Of course, the dream remains of that promised land of the Premier League. And it's been a fair start to the campaign, as I say, currently in ninth with 14 points. One thing I do want to touch upon, though, with you, is you mentioned, and I think it's so fair, that it is so sad, isn't it, that there are no fans available. But I think in a way it's even more sad from your perspective and Brentford's. Obviously this wonderful new arena, the Brentford Community Stadium, and know an awful lot of your heart, soul, passion and, you know, money as well has gone into this project. And it's a real delightful stadium. Obviously at the moment can't be graced with the fans. But Cliff, I want to ask you, obviously as a man around Brentford, when you're talking to the fans, just from what they can see, obviously they can't experience yet, what's been the feedback? Are they just chomping at the bit to get in there and lend their support to the Bees?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously they're missing the football first and foremost, but there is this magic about the new stadium.
Yeah,
we have been very fortunate that the last two away games, we've managed to have some fans in the lounges.
Mm-hmm.
The games on a beanbag on TV screens. So we've been able to give them a little bit of food and drink whilst they watch the games. And that's gone down extremely well. And whilst we haven't been able to give them a full tour of the stadium,
mm-hmm.
to have a look at some of the lounges and some of the areas, and they've been impressed. We did start doing some tours, which obviously now has ceased because of lockdown. Mm-hmm. But we have done something like 500 people have gone on tours of the stadium, and they've really, really been impressed. It's a very tight site, Tony.
Mm.
So some people look at it and think, how on earth could you get a football stadium in such a small area? But we've managed to do it. It's something that I personally have worked on for almost 10 years. And so to see it come to fruition is great. I just hope and pray that in the turn of the new year, we will see some improvement, significant improvement in the onset of coronavirus, and that the government will relent and allow us to get some fans back in the stadium, because we've done a lot of work and we believe that we can very safely have up to 5,000 fans in our stadium. And if we do that, it means that all of the ticket holders can get to at least see every other game. And that's something we're desperate for them to do.
Cliff, here, and we can only, as you say, wait, pray, and see what develops. It's such a surreal time. It changes all the time. But irrespective of that, I do want to just pass on our respect and congratulations, because, again, a decade's worth of planning, implementation, all the crazy logistics and bureaucracy behind these big projects, and it is a reality, and it can only be, fingers crossed, a matter of time before it truly becomes as it had ought to be, with thousands upon thousands of cheering bees fans lending their support to a promotion dream again this campaign.
Yeah, so I was only talking to a fan literally half an hour ago. The board members take it in turns to ring up fans and wish them happy birthday on their big birthdays. And I was talking to a lady and saying, how marvelous would it be if we could get the fans back in the stadium for the last, say, four or five games and see that as our promotion push to get into the Premier League. It's a dream and we can carry on dreaming. Why not?
Indeed. And you at Brentford have proven time after time to us all that dreams indeed do come true. So we'll watch this space and see how it develops. And incidentally, another massive bit of praise there, because in this era of kind of corporate world, and oftentimes, you know, Premiership clubs and indeed Championship clubs get tarnished kind of negatively, I feel sometimes. I think that touch there, that community outreach, Cliff, is a real classy act. And I'm sure it will be massively appreciated, because you understand, and just give me your take on this, how crucial the club is to the community there.
Absolutely. I mean, we do an enormous amount of work in the local community and in boroughs in and around Brentford. So the work that we do with the fans, with people in the community with disabilities, the elderly, the young, the infirm, I mean, it's a real part of the DNA of Brentford Football Club. And to be fair, almost every single club is the same. They do fantastic work in their local communities. And this is why it's so critical that clubs are protected and can survive, because it's not just about a football club. It is about a community. We saw the impact the demise of Bury had on the people of Bury. The impact it had on local businesses, on fans, on the people in the community. The work that we do, all of us football clubs, is so important that we have to be cherished and looked after and supported to ensure that we can continue to do the great work that we all do across England for the benefit of our communities.
Hear, hear. Brilliant message, powerfully delivered there, Cliff. I appreciate that massively. Before we move on and just kind of put a few big matches coming up under the microscope, I just want to circle back briefly, because it was quite fun last season to talk to you about the famed BMW team there that you had. Said had past tense, because Ben Rama are now off to West Ham. Obviously, Ollie Watkins already amongst the goals at Aston Villa. But we mentioned last time we spoke about their potential replacement, Ivan Toney, and he's been amongst the goals, hasn't he? Goodness me, I think he's bagged 9 goals already this season. We identified him as somebody who'd come up from a slightly lower league, not necessarily with a chip on the shoulder, but certainly the kind of Brentford DNA, if that makes any sense, kind of loaded. How impressed have you been with Ivan Toney's efforts so far this campaign?
I just can't even begin to tell you, Tony. I knew he was a goal scorer, and I was told that when he joined us, he would score goals for us. And the way we play football, the opportunities we create, we were guaranteed to get goals from Ivan Toney. But let me tell you, I've watched each of his games, and he brings so much more to the team than just his goals. His all-round play, he's brilliant in the air, his layoffs, his flicks, his passes, his commitment and work ethic. It's almost like watching another Ollie Watkins. Nice. And I give him higher praise than that.
Again, it's a reflection. We speak and we heap praise, and it's not hyperbole. It's just a reflection of the amazing year-on-year improvements that Brentford have been putting in over the last several years. And that's, again, you've been dubbed the Moneyball team. But your scouting infrastructure pan the world is, I think, almost second to none. And again, obviously, we don't just look on stats and these things do matter. What's always been strong for me, I think more critical than all the sort of the statistical analysis that's so important, is your final measure of that character. The kind of, do they fit in? Are they going to be willing to put a shift in? And it's very clear he's ticked that box, and I'm sure he'll continue to do that. But just again, remind us, Cliff, of how crucial this impressive scouting infrastructure is that you've developed.
Well, we've been very successful. There's no question about that. The numbers speak for themselves. But, you know, Ivan Toney is an example of someone who most other clubs knew about. He's not a prize package. You know, when we bought Saeed Bumrama or we bought Brian Mbeumo, clubs were saying, well, don't know them, never heard of them, what have they done? But Ivan Toney was a known package.
Mm-hmm.
Scored 24 goals for Peterborough last year and had been very successful, leading goal scorer. Same with Charlie Good, we bought from Northampton. He was in the team of the season in League Two last year. We're just prepared to make a concerted effort to buy somebody and then develop them and help them improve. And it's not just about the recruitment, because that's part of the job. The next part of the job is, once they join us, to get them to integrate into the way we play, our style of play,
mm-hmm.
help them improve and develop so that they can go on and have a really successful career. And please God, that will be with Brentford and hopefully in the Premier League.
Absolutely. And I tell you what, it's a better start to this campaign than it was last. So it's just, we all know, don't we? It's a very long, very turbulent, very challenging league, the Championship. We've said it before. I would suggest maybe the most challenging league in all of football. But again, on paper, on pace for pace, certainly ahead of where you were. So that's certainly a big positive. Quick question, though, again, referring back to this sensational kind of scouting aspect that is core to your successes. If Toney wasn't necessarily a surprise package, maybe somebody who has been is the Finnish star, Mikko Fors, just 21 years of age. And his goals to game, or minutes to game, is sensational. I had to sort of double check this because it made my eyebrows raise. 4 goals in just 111 minutes of action. Astonishing. And again, what's the story with that? And he must be feeling really like he's an important member of the team now.
Absolutely. And Marcus is a classic case of a young boy that we brought in a couple of years ago, and he developed with our B team. We sent him out on loan to AFC Wimbledon last season. He scored, I think, 11 goals for them. Proved that he can do it at League One level. Came back. Obviously, Ollie moves on. Ivan comes in. And suddenly, Marcus is our number two striker. And very, very important part of the group. As I said earlier, lots of games. People are going to get injuries. It's really important that clubs have really two good players for every position. And when you can take off a scorer like Ivan Toney and bring on a Marcus Fors, wow, that is one really strong combination that enables you to keep scoring goals. And we saw it on last Saturday at Luton. Marcus's first touch, ball through from Mathias Jensen, ball's in the back of the net. A very deft finish from a man who is a real fox in the box.
Every team needs one, but they are hard to find, and you've got maybe two, perhaps even three. Again, I just love that about this, because, you know, there was no sense of doom and gloom, was there, with the kind of the movement on of two of the three of that famed BMW. It's just, well, opportunity knocks. Who's going to take that opportunity? And I guess that's a massive credit to you guys. You mentioned that big win over Luton. Again, away 3-0. Important, unbeaten now in the last two, a draw before that against Norwich, who of course were a Premier League team themselves last season, off to a good start themselves, up in fourth. So that's two big fixtures and two big results. But we've said it, haven't we? This championship is so challenging and it doesn't get any easier, does it? It's coming up, I think, literally tomorrow. It's second-placed Swansea. They are there, very combative, 18 points from their matches so far. Obviously, again, you're coming in this on good form, but Swansea unbeaten themselves into looking for a third straight win. Quickly, your thoughts ahead of this challenging fixture?
Yeah, it's going to be a good game, Tony. No question, they're a very strong team. And, excuse me, they'll give us a really good game. We saw that in the playoff semi-finals last season.
Yep.
Open attacking football, plenty of quality. But I think we can certainly match them every step of the way. And I'd be very hopeful that we could pick up the 3 points.
And then another big home game on Saturday, hosting Middlesbrough themselves up in fifth. So these big matches keep coming. But again, we would be hoping by them that to be unbeaten in three. There is no real massive differences there between the top five and maybe the bottom five in this championship, as we say. But this is a pretty challenging double whammy. And if you come through them both positively, you're going to be knocking on the door of those higher places in the league again, aren't you? And I guess that will be the aspiration for all at the club.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody knows it's a long season. We all recognise that until you get to round about 10 or 12 games, you don't really know how things are panning out. Last season, after 11 games, we had 12 points. Mm-hmm. We were 2-0 down to Millwall and staring 17th place, maybe even lower in the division. We came back and won 3-2 on that day with three goals in the last 11 minutes. We kind of kicked on from there, and the rest of the season was quite superb. So long way to go. Lots can happen. We might be ninth, but Swansea might be second, but there's 4 points in it. If we win tomorrow night, there's only 1 point in it. So lots to play for. I wouldn't get too excited about where we are in the league until but I think as long as we're within touching distance of the top three or four, then we'll be in good shape. And as you say, we've made already a much better start this year than actually any year that we've been in the championship.
Wise words spoken wisely, but I just want to look slightly further into the future. I know that's always a dangerous thing to do, but it's also quite exciting because Carabao Cup quarterfinals beckons. And I don't think it's fair to call you giant killers, but you've certainly been Premier League slayers, haven't you, in your run, taking out Fulham, maybe a modicum of revenge there, taking out Southampton and also West Brom, and you're hosting Newcastle on Tuesday the 22nd of December, just a few days before Christmas. That could be quite a nice present if you can get a semi-final run in the Carabao Cup. Again, I know there's a focus on the league. I totally get that. But just begin to build the excitement for this in the near future quarterfinal.
Absolutely. I mean, it's our first ever appearance in the quarterfinal stage of the Carabao Cup. So for us, it's a big game. We'll give it everything we can. We're playing yet another Premier League team. There can't be many non-Premier League teams who would have knocked out four in one competition. So that's something to set ourselves up with as an opportunity. But frankly, between now and then, there's so many games to play. Yeah. That it'll be more a question of what players are available. We've got obviously a heavy Christmas period of games as well. So you have to take all these things into account. Players may be carrying slight strains. Mm-hmm. It's really challenging, particularly after obviously only a short break in the summer. So we'll forget about that for now. Of course, we're excited. Unlikely we're going to have any fans in the stadium, so that's obviously disappointing. But when we get there, we'll be ready for it. We'll give it our best shot. But so much can happen between now and then that it's almost impossible to say which players will be available. But whoever is available, I believe in the depth of the squad, we'll give it everything we can to get into the semi-finals, which then is only a one-legged game, which gives us an even better opportunity, potentially, to make it through to the final.
Brilliant stuff, and I look forward to building up to that with you nearer the time. For tonight, though, I've got to tell you, I always value your time. Obviously, two big fixtures coming up, Swansea and Middlesbrough. But just in closing, I'm sure many people listening would be quite eager to learn a bit more about Brentford's, and obviously there's no fans at the moment able to enter your new arena, but there's so much great information on your website. Can you just refresh our memories? Tell us the best way to engage with you online to find out more.
Yes, please do. If anyone is interested, go onto our website, www.brentfordfc.com. There's lots and lots of information. We are a gold standard family club. So we've got fantastic facilities in the new stadium for families to come along and watch games when fans are allowed back in. We've got some lovely lounges at Griffin Park. We could give you a lunch before the game for 50 people. We can now do it for something like 1,500 people. So the opportunities are there. We're playing great football at the moment. And I just hope and pray that everyone stays safe, stays well. We get through this next lockdown and come out of it the other side in good shape, and then hopefully get fans back into the stadium to enjoy perhaps the closing couple of months or so of the season.
Perfect. Cliff, I really appreciate your time, your input, and all the great work that you continue to do for Brentford Football Club and the community base that extends beyond it. Thank you for joining me again and being on our 100th podcast special from me and all at Verum Sports, saluting you and team and wishing you well for the upcoming matches and indeed beyond. Thank you very much again.
Thanks, Tony, and many congratulations to you on your 100th podcast.